Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the front pages before we meet our panel. So the Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a story. It's kind of out of the blue a bit, but there's apparently a major RTE documentary tomorrow night in association with the Mail on Sunday. And the first line in this is: the Vatican banned Bishop Eamon Casey from public ministry for life after receiving multiple child sexual abuse allegations against him. The Irish Mail on Sunday can reveal. And of course, we knew some of this story, but we'll tease out what's new there in a minute. And then the Sunday Times, a lot in the papers today, obviously, about Coolock. The Sunday Times leading with: anti-asylum riots will keep coming, fear senior Gardaí. There's just a little line in that, very simple little line, and it does make you think, yeah. They're talking about the need for more community engagement, and they mention more community Gardaí on the ground, liaising with local people and listening to them. So, which is something we forget about, which could help. The Sunday Independent are leading with that: an IT expert at a top firm is suspected of money laundering for gangs, but their off-lead is Gardaí like lambs to the slaughter in Coolock disturbance. And that is a frontline Garda officer who was there on Monday, has written quite a strong piece inside about her experience of it. The Business Post: 13 billion budget trick, how coalition plans to mask its spending splurge. So they're tutting about, I suppose, what you might call a bit of financial gimmickry, but I say all most people will see is 13 billion budget trick, but we might try and explain that in a while. Irish Sunday Mirror is leading with 9 million drug and cash bust. Man arrested as Gardaí probe links to Kinahan cartel. The Sunday World: cash gang wallop, mob linked to drug dealing brothers hit with hammer blow after Gardaí sees 8 million in cocaine, ketamine and MDA plus a million in cash. And then the front of the Sun on Sunday have a weapon seizure. The main suppliers of weapons for Ireland's lethal crime gangs have been taken out by Gardaí. So the Gardaí on the front of all the tabloids, very busy and doing great work there. Okay, our panel this morning: Aisling Maloney is political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Suzanne Rogers is research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Mick Clifford is a special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. And David Quinn is a columnist with the Sunday Independent. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning,
Brent. So, Mick, if we could start with Eamon Casey. Like, he's a kind of a totemic figure in our recent history. And there used to be then this kind of semi-rueful joke, which wasn't even that accurate, that, well, at least when that scandal came out and we didn't know what was to come, at least that was dealing with adults and everything, which, of course, not true. We did know some of this story here, but can you tell me what is new in this Daily Mail investigation?
Yeah, I suppose, Eamon, for our Brendan.
Yeah, do you want to give a bit of background?
Yeah, I suppose, particularly for any younger listeners, I think it was 1992 it emerged that Eamon Casey had fathered a child. Now, that Eamon Casey was a bishop. He was a very colourful character, being Bishop of Galway, Kerry prior to that, Bishop for the Immigrants in London. He was, in some ways, people would regard him as a model face of the church at the time, and a very popular figure.
And people will remember when the Pope came and everything, Eamon Casey was the MC kind of
very much
and
so.
And this was when priests were kind of major characters.
Absolutely.
In the entertainment media, church
theory as well.
But it was a shock. I was just saying it outside. I was actually abroad at the time. I remember being in Tokyo. I was travelling around at the time and reading this in the Japan Times, that a bishop in Ireland, it had been revealed, had fathered a child. As I told someone, I had a few jars the night before. I thought it might still be something wrong. It was that kind of craziness. It was both world news, but within this country, it was a massive shock in light of the status of the church as it had been for decades and decades prior to that. The idea that a bishop could have fathered a child was just
this was the beginning of it.
And then we're only a few short years on from that. We have the lights of States of Fear. We have everything tumbling out about child sexual abuse within the church. church and that, which was all in a totally different realm, a completely different realm altogether. And all of that, as we know, carried on. But as you say, like there was a notion at the time, well, Eamon Casey was a saint compared to what came out after that kind of thing. All the man did was engage in sexual relations with another adult and fathered a child. It has now emerged that it would certainly seem, and it wasn't a one-off, there's at least five allegations that are recounted here, one including one from his niece, in three different dioceses at the time. And these allegations have come out from 2001 up as far as 2016. In one instance, there was a settlement for €100,000. Now, you know, nobody's saying anybody's guilty of anything, but if a settlement is made of that order, one imagines that certainly the church or whomever made the settlement was under the impression that it was required.
And then a second settlement as well. There seems to have been one in the High Court, as far as we can see, and there was another settlement in the institutional redress.
Exactly, scheme. Yeah. Right. There was another one in the redress as well as that. And it's also been revealed that the Vatican had deigned that he was not to say Mass or partake in any ministries in that respect, which he, according to the Mail today, that he didn't adhere to that he broke that a number of times. But again, the Vatican doing that and reaffirming it later suggests that they were taking these allegations very seriously at a time when the church was under serious pressure because it was coming out all over the place. So the whole thing, whatever about the church dividing, it casts Eamon Casey in a much, much darker light than I think any of us would have thought of before. He died in 2017 after spending period in South America. He went to Britain for a while. And then one of them, I think it was his niece, made a criminal complaint to the UK police, which I find unusual because I think the allegation related back to his time in one of the dioceses in Ireland. She was living in the UK. He may have been at the time, but at the same time...
Was he in that diocese at the time in England?
Yeah, but as far as I understand, the actual allegation related to what might have happened when he was back years earlier in Ireland. So maybe that... Anyway, one way or the other, I don't think that criminal investigation went anywhere. But it certainly is... It's a major rewriting of our perceptions and the character of Eamon Casey, I think, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and as you say, some young people will be kind of baffled at this and everything, but David, it is for people of a certain age, this is, as Mick says, it's a kind of a recasting of this figure, isn't it?
Yeah, because it just places him, as Mick says, in a much, much worse light. I mean, it's... It's encouraging that he was actually kept out of ministry even after he came back to Ireland or went back to Britain. The kind of line to draw on these stories sometimes is 1996, because 1996 is the year that the church brought out its first child protection guidelines about how to handle allegations when they come in. I remember being at the press conference when this set of guidelines was launched, and it was launched by the late Cardinal Cottle Daly. So from then on, as an allegation of child abuse comes in, this is how you're supposed to handle it. You move the priest aside, you take him out of ministry, you investigate, you tell the Gardaí, even if the person themselves hasn't told the Gardaí, you tell the Gardaí. They have their own investigation. You have an investigation within the church itself, because if you can't have a criminal investigation because it doesn't meet the standard of evidence, you still have an investigation within the church, and that investigation might lead to...
Just so I'm clear, post-1996, there was a kind of... wasn't there a sense prior to that that canon law superseded the law of the land? So from 1996, the law of the land was respected as much by the church and involved as much by the church as canon law, yes.
Yeah, well, kind of, because actually, I mean, what was going on was even worse, really. They weren't using any law, whether it be canon law or civil law. They were just saying, this is going to harm the reputation of the church, so we're not going to tell anybody about it. We're not going to conduct an internal investigation. We're not going to hand it over to the civil authorities either.
Okay, and do you think in this case, so basically, no, I don't want to bog people down in too much detail here, but it does seem that the one case the case in 2006, the Vatican got complaints. There was no prosecution directed in that by the DPP, so clearly in some way went to law. In 2015, further allegations to the Vatican, and what they say in their statement today is that he had mental and physical problems at that stage, which I guess we can imagine what that might have been, which would have made it difficult to mount a defence. So there was no case ever successfully prosecuted against him. Equally, the Vatican doesn't appear to have told anyone why he was taken out of ministry, did they?
I don't know. I mean, it's pretty hard to get across all the detail of it, and this kind of follow up questions.
I think that's what it seems like. Okay. That they didn't ever
communicated their decision to ban Bishop Casey from the ministry to the public. Not the outcome, but they didn't communicate that he wasn't allowed to administer.
Yeah, I mean, you see, I mean, like if the thing went to the guards and the guards investigate, or the DPP and decides not to send a file, do you tell the public then? I'm not sure what the civil law says then about what you ought to do. So I think it's a little bit...
But there were payouts and they were clearly taking it seriously enough to take him out of ministry. Yeah. But they decided we'll keep this as an internal matter.
But even within the Catholic Church, it seems in Ireland, like within different dioceses in the country, they weren't aware because he was administering Mass in Wexford or took part in Mass.
I think off his own bat, in fairness.
But that's what they say in Limerick, that he showed up and they weren't aware that he wasn't
allowed. And it sounds like there were complaints
made
to the Papal Nuncio each time he turned up at somebody's Jubilee Mass. He turned up infamously at the niece he abused, turned up on the altar at her mother's funeral, and I think she was deeply traumatised by it. And then he seems to have turned up at the funeral of a grandnephew of him
in Wexford.
And who had died in an accident.
Yes, and in Limerick, in the situation in Limerick, they talk about how the Limerick Diocese confirmed that it was not notified of any restrictions in place at the time on Bishop Casey. So I suppose, look, there's a lot of detail, as you say, in this investigation in an RTE documentary tomorrow. Many years of looking into this issue from Anne Sheridan in the Mail on Sunday. And I suppose even to say, you know, obviously we knew Bishop Casey and what he had done in the early 90s and what happened, and people had one opinion, and as you say, it was sectioned
almost,
off as something.
Benign.
What followed came, yeah. But I mean, just to look at this now, I suppose, look, the man is dead now. But what we see here is the same issues of the level of child safeguarding not being taken seriously in terms of files going missing. There was one file in the UK about an allegation in 2001 from the Diocese of Limerick to the Diocese in Brighton where he was that went missing. And this thing about different dioceses not being aware, the idea that, you know, it's kind of the secrecy and not being shared. And where is the safeguarding there? And you see there, Patricia... O'Donovan, whose niece alleges abuse by him, she talked about how she was aware. She finally reported the abuse when she was aware that he was visiting someone staying overnight where there was a teenage girl, and that was in my mind when I picked up the phone, and all I thought of was that girl. How is it the victims that are the ones to protecting other victims? Why isn't it the systems and the people
and she was
that
unaware
you trust
as well, that
in the community?
There were two complaints already. Suzanne, are people going to just think, yeah, sure, like this is how it was, ancient history, it's all been done? Are we still shockable by any of this stuff?
Like when you say ancient history there, I think that's the bit that really upsets me, is that systems generally protect themselves. So that's the way that systems work. And we today in Ireland, as we speak, we are still seeing vulnerable people you know, not being protected by systems when they fall victim to abuse. So I just wonder, it's the ancient history piece that really, you know, that's the bothers me. That, and I'm not talking about sort of church abuse, but just people in vulnerable situations, you know, who think that they're going to be protected by the system and they're not being protected by the system. So I think we still have a massive amount of work to do across the board in all of these spaces.
So there's broader learnings here is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, what we're dealing with there largely historically, I think, in terms of the church as an institution, what was done to children. I mean, Suzanne's point is well made. Unfortunately, and not on purpose or anything, but by neglect most of the time, the state, unfortunately, is culpable in that respect now, in certain scenarios as well now, you know, when there's not proper safeguards in place, when you don't have child and family agency properly resourced, all that sort of thing. It's going on in a different guise now.
David, from the point of view of any insights on how this affects Catholics at this stage, there's a bruised and battered generation of women, particularly, I would say, who, you know, some of them, I think a lot of them actually kind of semi gave up and went into some kind of their own personal relationship with Mass and religion and everything, and have disregarded the institutional church. Some of them have hung in there into old age despite all of this. Does this again today is very upsetting for people all over again, like, and
Well, when I, you know, like when I'm at Mass and you look around and it's mainly older people there. I mean, usually they're well past the age of 65, and you kind of ask yourself, you know, why are they still coming, given all the scandals and all the disillusionment and so on? And I think it's mainly because they have a kind of personal relationship with their own Christian faith. They want to express it in some kind of communal way.
Yeah.
They're coming out of habit partly as well. They make a distinction between the institution and its many failings and their own parish, for example. So often you find that people, and I'm talking about Massgoers here, they might give out about the church in general terms, they might give out about it as an institution. They will be appalled by the scandals and the failures and abuses that are involved in clericalism itself, by which I mean a self-protective group of people, like you get in many walks of life, unfortunately. But they often then like their own parish.
They like their own parish priest. Their own priest as well, don't they? Yeah, yeah, they're very popular priests around the country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
people manage to divorce them at all in a way, don't they?
Yeah, so they make a distinction between what they experience locally in their own parish and then the national institution quite often.
Okay, all right. So look, we move on to a lot across all the papers about the, I think, ongoing is a fair word to use about what's going on out in Coolock. Suzanne, why don't we go to that front page of the Sunday Times? Anti-asylum rights will keep coming, fear senior Gardaí. That's Claire Scott, John Mooney and Michael McNiff. You picked that piece.
The whole conversation, we were just even talking before we came on air, and every time I would go, I think, and then I would have to pause because I don't actually know what I think a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It's really nuanced. There's a lot of things happening at the same time, and we seem to be having real difficulty in having debate, discussion, separating things out. When we look at where international protection accommodation centres are being set, the Parliamentary Budgetary Office did a piece there in January. And in most counties, those centres, and I appreciate the government may have to take what it can get, but they are being located in areas that are already disadvantaged. So what you've got then is communities who have systematically, repeatedly, continually being told there are limited resources and you're not getting any, and now they're being asked to move up one in the bed. So I can understand where there are legitimate concerns in any community where a huge number of people is going to come in who need extra support, you already don't have access to a GP, you already don't have access to speech and language development for your kid, you're already on a waiting list for your child to get diagnosed for something, you're already on waiting list for 18 months for a minor surgery or something like that. So there's definitely a conversation about resources and infrastructure, and I think that's being drowned out by bad faith actors. I don't even know what words to use anymore. So I just think.
But are saying that people in these communities are tending to think of the migrants as someone to blame for all those problems.
I think it's because we like simple answers to really complex problems. And we've seen it again across our own society. We've always had somebody to point at and say, this is the reason why your pension can't be increased. This is the reason why, we can't put something here, why we can't afford a hospital or something like that. So we've always had somebody somewhere that we can point at and blame. And I often think we need to be looking up, wherever the money is going, it's not going into the pockets of asylum seekers. They get, about 30, 39 euro a week, I think. I mean, at the moment, there are 2,399 eligible males in the international protection accommodation, who are awaiting accommodation. In the grand scheme of things, that is actually quite a small number. You know, it's 2,000 people that we don't seem to be able to accommodate. I appreciate that migration.
Well, it's part of that issue because when we do try and accommodate them in certain places, the places get burnt out as soon as people get wind of it.
This is it. So you're kind of going, you have to ask yourself why. I mean, we were just saying, I don't get to veto my neighbours. So if those locations where we're getting planning permission to put in a 200, bedroom unit or something like that, something that would accommodate 200 people, but it was going to be a six-storey apartment block, you wouldn't be having these sort of conversations. So for me, it's about resourcing, it's about infrastructure, it's about communities that have been left behind. And I just wonder if those centres were being placed in other parts of cities or other parts of counties, would we see the same sort of pushback?
Okay. David Quinn, do you think that is the issue then?
Well, I think it's partly the issue, yes. I mean, obviously...
So if we resourced all these communities properly, there wouldn't be an issue here?
I'm not sure. I mean, what I notice is, and this is kind of ironic, really, the more asylum seekers come into the country, the more unpopular Sinn Féin seems to get. It doesn't seem to affect the government at all. And I think one of the reasons has to be because a lot of these centres have been moved into working class areas, they're not being moved into middle class areas where there's a lot of Fine Gael support. So I suspect that if they were moving large numbers into Fine Gael strongholds, in South Dublin, for example, I suspect actually Fine Gael will begin to become very unpopular, because I suspect it's not just a question of resources. I suspect people are also thinking, I don't know how this is going to affect my community. How's it going to change it? It's all very unpredictable. Why is the government moving them into my area, not some other area? And this is, of course, is always the point. But I think working class areas, certainly, and rural areas and these small rural communities, you know, when they see... these large numbers, 500 in the case is the aim, and Coolock being moved into a place like Coolock and not being moved into a place like Donnybrook or Ranelagh or whatever the case may be, well, then they're entitled to kind of be annoyed about that. And I mean, Fine Gael can surely see that it's not affecting their poll ratings, but it is affecting Sinn Féin's poll ratings pretty dramatically.
Okay. So, Mick, back to the question then of, if you look, though, at the videos from Coolock and stuff during the week, I don't think most people are seeing that there's this kind of cohort of decent people there with legitimate concerns and everything. It looks like something quite different to that. Obviously, there are layers here.
There are. And I mean, you talk about the pictures that are conveyed there, like from much of the analysis I've seen from crime journalists in particular who are on the ground there, you're talking about the actual violence was a very small number of people, and they tended to be very young people, even though, no, that isn't borne true completely in terms of those who were before the courts and what have you. But to a large extent, that is the case. But I mean, what you have
is... No, I saw one of the far right politicians addressing a crowd there,
yeah.
And seemed to be addressing quite a large crowd.
Well,
and,
the crowd
and,
there is large.
And a supportive crowd as well. So you can't just say there are a bunch of people who aren't thinking about the far right at all and are just their legitimate concerns, and there's a bunch of Tuaregs causing trouble then. There is a coming together here occurring, isn't there?
Absolutely. What is propagated online by these far right elements, it gets into the psyche of people, and when you keep repeating something, when you keep presenting it as the case, when you keep telling people what the state, the government, the system is doing to you, absolutely, there's complete crossover in it. I'm talking about the difference. For example, there's another story in the Sunday Times today about Dundrum and County Tipperary. They have a similar scenario. The difference being, first of all, it's a far smaller community, and secondly, that it's not overall as deprived or have a concentration of deprivation as you would have in Coolock. The thing down in Dundrum is about, and this is very typical of a lot of small communities around the country where this is affected, a hotel that closed down back 2015 and now it's being used for that. Those people thought, very understandably, and hoped more than thought, that one day this would reopen and it would be an economic point that would benefit the town. Now you go to Coolock, you had a paint factory there, there was 500 jobs, I'm not sure how many exactly.
I don't know if there were 500.
Sorry, yeah, I don't know how many jobs were there. Yeah. But there was a factory there that was an economic unit. This is being put in there instead. Now, people are talking about lack of consultation. To be fair, in this instance, there was consultation initially. It was not continual. It was not with all elements of the community.
And it was with local representatives.
With local representatives. Yeah. And I think one or two people from local organisations. But the point I'm making is, at that point 3 months ago, if you had a whole of government approach, what should have been done is they should have told the reps, this has to be moved in here for various reasons. We are supplementing this with a package of supports and aids for your community. We understand it's deprived. Some areas of funding have not got back to 2008 levels in Coolock. Now, if they came in, if you had a whole of government approach like
and the
that,
government is saying we do have a fund here and we are spending.
We have a fund and you have various organisations like a partnership, like others, and we would envisage putting A, B and C into this. Now, at least you get people on side. That does not mean the far right element will not try to get at people that way. It does not mean that you won't have youths who are bored in scenarios like this who begin violence, but it would be a very different context at the same time. If you try and get people on side by admitting that yes, there is social deprivation here, but we have to do this, but we intend to alleviate the worst of the deprivation, if you're able to go along
but
with
you
us
also,
like this.
But the asylum system system also has to work properly because they're processing claims incredibly slowly. There's about 20,000.
Yeah,
no, I'm not. Yeah. I'm just making the additional point.
No, that's true.
So about 10,000 have come in to claim asylum since the start of this year. That's twice what it was last year. There's about 20,000 in the system that apparently will take about 2 years to process at the current rate. That's without all the people being added on. Now, there's a guy, Michael Flynn, in the Sunday Independent today. He has a letter there. He used to work in the asylum system for the government, so he knows the system inside and out. And his continual complaint is the extreme slowness of processing complaints. And when a person has failed in their asylum claim, very little happens.
Yeah.
They remain in the country. Unless you begin to take control over the asylum system, this is going to keep mounting.
Yeah, he's a frequent letter writer and often quite interesting letters. But he does make a point today as well that Mr. O'Gorman has spent close to $1 billion of taxpayers' money on accommodation in 2023. In contrast, his department spend on youth services in 2023 was $79 million. Which,
we are not out of line with other Western European countries. There are issues worldwide. There is serious conflict. This is before we get to what you might call climate refugees, when that starts to increase. We're not out of line with other European countries.
Okay, I want to bring in Suzanne there because
we are. Sorry, if you take Denmark, same size country as us. A tenth the number of asylum seekers coming in. They have a social democratic government. I mean, that's something that needs to be explored sometime.
Social democratic, not as it would be understood in the rest of Europe, though. They have policies whereby they integrate the children. They have to spend 25 hours of the week apart from their parents and stuff.
I think
people would find some of that not very socially democratic in other countries.
You see, there's a social democratic dilemma across Europe, and to a certain extent Sinn Féin faces it too. Because they have this traditional working class support, and as those areas are most nervous about large numbers coming into the country, like it or not, they are. And these social democratic parties are thinking, do we go with the concerns of our traditional working class supporters, or do we go with what we just call multiculturalism? And in most countries, the social democratic countries have gone with multiculturalism, and they have lost their working class supporters to the likes of Le Pen in France, AfD in Germany, and so on down the list. The Danish Social Democrats decided we're not going to lose the working class support, we're going to stick with them, and they decided to bring in strict rules. Whether we like them or not, it's certainly a thing to debate, because it can be done if you want. I think they're too strict, by the way. I think you're right about that. I think they're too strict. But the difference is 10 to 1 between Ireland and Denmark, even taking into account population
size. Okay, Ashley.
Well, no, there's more than that, too. Yeah. If you look down the lists, we have an unusually high number. We have more coming in per head of population now than Italy, that's a frontline country.
Yeah, but we originally wouldn't have had as many frontline, like we wouldn't have gotten the amount that Italy, you know, Greece, all of those frontline countries got. So we are far from the frontline, but we are a part of a bloc as well that is trying to handle migration as a bloc and not as individual countries. And the idea that, I suppose, Ireland, little old Ireland on the periphery of Europe, could handle us all on our own is kind of ridiculous when you think about the amount of people we're going to see. Mick mentioned there about climate change refugees, as people can't live in certain areas of the world, literally because it is literally too hot to live there, or the flooding is so bad on the reverse, or there's famine. So we are going to see more people get here.
I've seen an expert on migration, I think she's with the ESRI, saying that it's a much more nuanced picture than that. And just throw this in as a piece of useless information. Apparently climate migration, people tend to move within
refugees move to the neighbouring country. But as those neighbouring countries bear the brunt more and more, those countries then succumb in many cases to more unrest because of the fact that they are put under so much pressure.
Okay.
And that's
Aisling, I want to go back to a bit of Coolock this week, because I think people are a bit shocked by what they're seeing there. But there's a couple of specific things in the papers today. One you picked out, which is Nicola Byrne writing in the Irish Mail on Sunday.
So Nicola Byrne, she wrote about how her car was damaged by protesters at the site, are estimated to be around 1,100 to repair. So she pulled up to the site at the Coolock Crown Paints factory at the end of April and visited on midday on a Friday afternoon. Now, she said she was taking precautions because she was alone and had endured abuse at other anti-immigration protests. She pulled up up, ask the protesters, what are you protesting against? And a middle-aged woman stood in front of her car, and someone leaned into the car and asked her, and he said, locals here don't want any more foreigners coming to the area. And when she suggested that they don't represent the views of everyone in the community, she was told to get out of here. The woman began to bang on the bonnet and the men thumped the roof. As I hurriedly put up the window, then there was a loud bang followed by another. One of the men, who was aged around 40, attempted to kick in the door of my car. I turned over the engine to drive to the Coolock Garda station about 2 minutes away. It took 10 minutes for a guard to come at the hatch at the office or at the Garda station. She explained what happened, and tellingly she said, I was warned not to go back. They told me they were very violent people at the protest, and it was very and that they were very dangerous, and look, that was it. And she said she followed up. Now, she had €1,100 estimated damage to her car, but the mechanic that she went to said that he could find an immigrant mechanic who could possibly panel beat it out for a smaller fee. And when she explained what happened to her at the site, that man, who was a migrant background, did it for €180, and the car is as good as new. Now, I mean, look, that story obviously is
itself. We're not tarring everybody with the same brush, but I think Kitty Holland, other journalists have had similar experiences.
This is symptomatic of a wider issue.
Which would make you think, like, that part of this thing that we see in America of this distrust of the mainstream media, and actually, you know, TikTok or whatever is where it's at.
Actually, Brendan, as well, like I was just saying outside, like I've been talking to some, like I'm new enough in the industry here, and like I wouldn't have many years of experience dealing with, I mean, any violent protests or anything like that. But a few people have said to me, like journalists my age, saying, I don't really know if I want to work in this area if this is what we're up against, if this is what we're faced with at these protests. It's just base level distrust. And I understand that there have been protests and riots, you know, in many decades of our country's history in with different backgrounds, but this kind of thing about the far right and people not even engaging with media are just totally casting us off as some agenda ridden, you know, mainstream media, that thing that they use. And actually, Colin Murphy's writing in the Sunday Independent today.
Can we come back to that one second? Just off what you were saying there, I just want to ask Suzanne about a piece you picked in the Sunday Times, Suzanne, which is John Mooney's piece, Inside, Get Out While You Can. This is just the start, EL protesters. But he has an expert in that piece saying that basically we're treating this as something, as if it's a particular confluence of circumstances, unhappy locals and a few, you know, far-righty politicians that there aren't many of in this country coming and taking advantage, whatever. This guy is saying, no, this is a violent political movement, and the sooner the state starts to recognise that and treat it like that, is this the beginnings of a violent political movement?
I sincerely hope not. But like that, I think maybe we don't want to sleepwalk our way into it. I mean, I know I'm kind of focusing on resources and infrastructure. Yeah. The racism part of it, I suppose, is there and does need to be acknowledged. And even like some of the pieces we've been reading this morning, like, you know, one person talks about, like, you know, that communities again, that, you know, there's a serious distrust of the state, so that anything that comes out from the state will be, you know, will be put to one side. But I go back to the, like, actions have consequences. So I'm looking as well at a lot of the stuff that's happening, especially from, again, outside actors, stuff on, you know, as you said, the incitement piece of it, I think is quite scary. I mean, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, because I don't think you'd be able to switch me off quick enough. But you know what I mean? But I would have to accept the consequences of that. So I kind of think sometimes that there's a bit of a lack between, as you said, to go and like damage somebody's car and then presume that there won't actually be any consequences of it. But even just to go back to your point, actually, the international protection piece,
it's actually
75%. Sorry, nobody can see us. 75% up on last year, the international protection applicants. But we've been at around sort of 3,000-4,000 a year. As you said, it's very, very slow. But it's the last 2 years have been extraordinarily high. It's been up around, again, when I say extraordinarily, it's still only about 13,000-14,000. And this year has been 75% up on last year.
I looked at the
And
I looked at the figures yesterday off the International Protection System website and I said 93% up.
I added up January, February, March, April, May, June.
So there was just over 10,000 in the first 6 months.
It's a big increase.
Yes. But they expect about 20,000 to come this year. That's what the ministry
But that's out of, like, there's 100,000 people enter this country. So migration is one conversation. Exactly. Refugees are another conversation. Mm. Yeah. Asylum seekers are a separate conversation again. And again, I think we just really need to be careful. Our post-pandemic economic recovery, because people like, you know, it's all about the Benji's baby. People like to know where their money's coming from, has been as a direct result of female participation in the workforce and inward migration.
Yeah. Okay. I want to read a few texts before we go to a break, right? Brendan, there are at least 5 centres in my electoral area of Dublin, 4 and 6, supported by local public reps. I'm sorry, Brendan, it's not just areas like Coolock have a lack of resources, says this texter. It's in most places at the moment and they don't turn to violence. We have the highest social welfare rates in Europe. That's from Fiona in Knock Lyon, who says she's without a doctor and can't afford the supermarket shop weekly. 220 asylum seekers were moved into a former nursing home in Dublin 4, says this texter. There's also an asylum centre in a former secondary school in a Fine Gael heartland in Limerick. There's no justification for the hatred whipped up by the far right in certain areas. Okay, we'll take a break. Aisling Maloney, Suzanne Rogers, Mick Clifford and David Quinn staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still here. Aisling Maloney, Suzanne Rogers, Mick Clifford and David Quinn. I don't want to get back embroiled in Coolock, but there's an email here from Ronan. The protesters are following the advice of criminals that just want to carve off areas where police can't go. This has happened in French cities, in particular Marseille, where cops can't enter. And Mick, you did pick a piece on the policing response here. There's been criticism of it from both ends, really.
Criticism both ends, and the Sunday Independent have looked at a first person piece from an anonymous Garda who was there. But it is pretty stark, you know, and just a bit of it there. I watched helplessly as the violence escalated. This is a Garda speaking now. Fences ripped down, rocks, glass bottles, wood rained down on me and my colleagues, just missing us. We were defenceless with no riot helmets or shields, nothing other than a standard pepper spray and a baton. There has been criticisms. There's been criticisms from the GRA. One of the things I found very stark, to be honest with you, the Gardaí moved in at 3:30, 4 a.m. in the morning. Now, that's understandable in itself to try and get the thing going. But by all accounts, most of the Gardaí left around 5:30 a.m. and it was only 5 hours later when things began to kick off that they came back. And if that's the case, like, you know, the idea that there wasn't going to be trouble here is something
they are kind of saying it was a strategy as well not to bring in the public order.
I understand that on one level.
See what happened in Leeds? There were riots in Leeds over the last few days, right? The police all withdrew en masse at a particular point, went and parked up, like in convoy, parked up in a local shopping centre, and they waited, and they seemed to be calling it dampening down. That sometimes, that the withdraw. Presence of guards and the presence of the riot squad escalates things, that if you stand back for a while, it seems that it does have the effect often of letting things resolve slightly, and then you go back in.
Not only that, but once you send in the riot squad, you're going to have complaints about brutality and all that. The riot squad, they go in, they have to, the way they clear things, they charge at people, that's their brief, that's what they have to do. So it's the last resort.
Yeah, it's not
resort.
Pretty like when you
no,
look at it.
No, it's the last course. Resort. Yeah, so yeah. You hang back for that reason, like, to be fair.
And I also think in Leeds, when you're talking there, that was in a housing estate and, like, obviously that was people's homes in the community that was rioting. In this case, you know, had the Gardaí withdrew, you might have seen way more criminal damage on the Crown Paints factory than there, you know, when you talk about that dampening down. But also the interesting thing is what's being brought up by the Garda representative associations and others talking to the Sunday Times as well, saying that lessons need to be learned, that there needs to be more community engagement. You kind of, we were talking there about you know, that the Gardaí need to do some community engagement over these centres and that kind of whole of government approach. But the idea that we've known with the last 3 months that there was going to be issues over that centre because it's been online, and the Justice Minister saying sadly a small minority of individuals are inciting violence and fear in an attempt to divide our communities. So you know they're inciting violence and fear online, but why haven't we stopped them? Why are they going on why are they continuing to incite violence?
And certainly
since March.
Yeah.
You know, this and the stuff that's written on the outside of that Crown Paints factory where they've put up the cement is abhorrently racist, what's written, like completely disgusting slurs. So it's not about some, obviously that faction of it is not about community resources. So and why in many are we ways, dampening
we seem
down
to be talking about
a,
quite a small group of people who they've been watching and have known for years.
I'm sure I watched them on TikTok last night. It was half an hour on the live watching a man talking to the Gardaí, with saying horrible things to the Gardaí outside Coolock.
Okay, so we move on to something of less consequence for us, but just as exciting. Yeah. David, why don't you kick us off on the ongoing... I mean, you'd say soap opera, but it has huge consequences for the world, I suppose. But the Michael Murphy in the Sunday Independent today writing about President angry with Obama over calls to quit. So the image we have now this weekend is that Biden is at his beach house stewing. Various suggestions that his family have come up with a plan and he might be coming around to things. More and more people coming out.
I mean, he's also had a statement out in the last few days, and the spokespeople have had statements out saying he's not for budging. I mean, like what we have now is something equivalent to what the Tory party does, and what they want to move for prime minister aside, they send in the 1922 committee. Yeah. And this is kind of what's happening here. And apparently, like, Obama is operating in the background and on manoeuvres, and Nancy Pelosi has been on public manoeuvres. But you see, what strikes me is, Biden's infirmities have been pretty visible for a long time. We all saw the videos of him stumbling up steps and trailing off in conversation and rambling talks and this kind of thing. And then suddenly it becomes an issue because he did so badly in the debate versus Trump. But I mean, there was obviously lots and lots of senior people in the Democrats knew what the score was with Biden. They knew for a long time back, and they were kind of fingers crossed and hoping for the best. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal, which is a very reputable paper, about 2 months ago, where they spoke to lots of people about his condition. And it was condemned widely in the likes of the New York Times and Washington Post. But it was a kind of cover-up, really, of what was wrong with Biden.
Implicit in what you're saying is that if the Republicans had done this, we would have been saying it's perverting democracy, etc.
Well, I wouldn't even say... perverting democracy. It's just ignoring things which are inconvenient. And it was inconvenient to point out what the story is of Biden. Mm-hmm. And given his age, like 81, he's not going to get better, is he? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I just love the way you said his condition. His condition is just old age. Yes. God forbid.
Well,
I know
90-year-olds would buy and sell Biden. That's just old age.
But anyway,
it's a particular kind of old age.
We'd all agree that, he's not in the best shape. It was apparent for a long time that he wasn't. Now the Democrats are in a panic. They're particularly in a panic because of the debate, because there's a little bit of a blip in popularity for Trump. They had a successful convention. They see that the things are beginning to move against them in the swing states. They think they might lose control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. So it's full panic stations.
Mm-hmm. So interestingly, this is something that's not in the papers this weekend, but I was watching Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's the congresswoman from New York, on Instagram Live. She did like an hour-long Instagram Live talking about, because she's a Democrat, talking about what was going on. She was like, I want to be transparent with you. It was real, Gen Z politics. She was like, I want to be transparent with you guys what I'm thinking. And I loved it. I watched nearly all of it. She was talking about how she was giving out about unnamed Democratic sources saying that, that they thought Joe Biden should give up the ghost. And she was giving out saying you should put your name to your comments. And she was doing that. So she was saying she's been in these rooms with these top Democrats where they're talking about their game plan. And her main point was that they don't really have a game plan. And she's concerned that the people making these decisions haven't fully thought through the implications. One being that there could be a very serious litigation launched by the Republicans, if the Democrats change the name or change their presumptive presidential nominee too late or at a certain deadline.
Really?
So that's one thing. Another thing.
He might not be, Biden, whoever the candidate is, might not apparently be on the ballot paper.
Exactly.
In Ohio,
in some
states, if they don't come up
I think
with,
it's like
with,
6 days after the Democratic convention, one of the states, I can't remember which one now.
No, I think before the convention, it could
that they
be.
Have to have the name. So that's one aspect of it. And another aspect of it was that Biden and Harris have been going around collecting this $100 million war chest for the election to defeat Trump. And apparently, if one of them is not on the ticket, that $100 million cannot be
put to
another one.
I think Harris can.
She can. But then the other point that the congresswoman was making... The other point the congresswoman is making is that the top Democrats aren't talking about subbing in Harris for Biden. They're talking about an entirely new ticket. They're not talking about Kamala Harris in any sense of the word. Obviously, she would be the most It would be the easiest course of action.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not what the top Democrats are talking about.
But I think
about.
As became clear when I was talking to Katrina Perry yesterday, they don't really have a clear plan for the day after. They need Biden out by Monday, right?
But
there's
who?
There's going to be no candidate unless I think Biden absolutely hands over to Kamala and that's accepted.
And
right?
Who wants
there's
to
no
be?
Candidate until yeah. the actual convention
that's
happens.
Part
then.
Of the reason, that's part of the reason what David was talking about, the hope against hope, was because all the way back, going back months and months, there was no candidate apart from Biden who looked like the possibility of taking on Trump. The irony is that if in 2016 Biden rather than Hillary Clinton had been the Democratic Party nominee, he would have beaten Trump. I mean, Hillary Clinton, in retrospect, particularly with that constituency, that white working class, she was a dead duck. Biden would have beaten Trump.
And apparently this is part of his problem at
exactly.
the moment, I've heard, which is that he's stewing back in that
yeah.
now. He was 3 months off the death of his son, Bo.
That's right.
He was in grief and he feels he was bounced by the Obamas
yeah.
and the Clintons
Ooh.
Into not running.
And if he had run...
And this has come back up
if
now.
He had run, we'd have heard no more about Donald Trump. Ironically, then, if he does run this time, there's no question Trump will win, I think.
Mm. And Suzanne, you want to come in there?
I'm just thinking, I wish Bill Hicks was still with us. I think he would have had the American comic. I think he would be having an absolute field day at the moment.
Well, I think you'll find that Donald Trump himself is managing to simultaneously do the comedy often while
yeah.
being the candidate.
But
it's
that's
bizarre.
That's the bit that kind of upsets me sometimes, is that this is serious stuff and I don't think he's taking it seriously. I don't think
Who's
he...
Not?
Donald Trump,
right.
sorry.
Oh, he takes himself very seriously.
But,
that's all he's worried about.
Like like it's a game, I think. It's a game he's playing. But what I find
but then
fascinating...
you did pick a piece in the Sunday Times today, which is Welcome to Trump 2.0, right? And, you know, people are saying there's no talk about policy here. But there are very clear policy lines laid out there. He's saying what he's going to do. We mightn't like some of it, but... He is saying what he's going to do.
Yeah, but like some of it, like the language that was in that piece, like war mode, find the conspirators. So like he's laying out his stall to say what he's going to do. But at no stage has he, you know, there's no discussion of this is a country with the highest amount of billionaires and millionaires in the world. 38 million people in America live in poverty. 17.3 million people live in deep poverty. Maternal mortality is on the up. They pay some of the lowest wages in the industrialized world. Americans die younger. They're less healthy, despite spending $4.3 trillion. That's the sort of policy discussion I wouldn't mind seeing. But that whole focus was about illegals, you know, the amount of money that they were going to put into ridding the country of the 11 to 20 million people who live there illegally. Like, that's the sort of policies that he's
yeah.
discussing.
There's
and
an interesting going to thing in there about that. A guy saying, who's worked with him on foreign policy, saying, look, Trump's a deal maker, right? Mm. So... He'll ring Russia and say, stop the war or I'll double the aid to Ukraine. Then he'll ring Ukraine and say, stop the war or I'll cut off the aid to you. And he'll do a deal that when he looks at Pyongyang, he just sees he sees condos and he'll get on to Kim Jong-il and say, look, let's just do a deal here.
He's been there already.
You kind of half wonder, like...
He had four years.
He had 4 years and nothing came of it. Like,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
there's talk as well, David, about Trump amnesia. Like, if we look back on Trump's presidency, I mean, on one hand, okay, things did happen and things did not happen. He would claim wars, etc. But it was chaos.
Sort of completely and utterly. I mean, and obviously January 6th was the principal example of that. But you see, again, it's a bit like what's happening with European politics. People who would have voted traditionally for left-wing parties are not doing so anymore because you get this migration of the working class. And we saw the Teamsters Union for the first time in decades addressing a Republican Party convention. I think they're the biggest trade union in the United States and endorsing Trump. And so you've got this blue-collar migration to Trump. And actually, some of the policies that Biden has brought in have been to try and essentially steal some of Trump's issues. So, for example, bring more jobs back to America, protect American manufacturing industry and what's left of it. Because the Democrats can see that they have lost a lot of their blue-collar working-class base. Trump did spot that. And in fact, Trump spotted it decades ago. He could see jobs were going to the likes of China and Mexico and wanted to try and bring them back to America. Lots of jobs, of course, were lost to automation as well. Biden now talks more about border control than he used to as well, because he knows lots and lots of Americans, like Europeans, are concerned about that issue and do want control over their borders and want people only coming in legally and then be processed, you know, properly. So Biden is also, you know, taking on that concern. Trump has been saying for years European countries need to spend more on their defence and not be free riding on America, because that makes, because the less obviously European countries spend on defence, the more they can spend on their welfare system, which has been free riding on the United States. So some of the issues he has made public and prominent are issues that are legitimate issues and issues actually that the Democrats, including Biden, have somewhat taken on board.
That's all very true, but at the heart of all that is the broken economic system. The working class ideal in America, you work hard, you get your pension, your kids can go to college, they're going to better themselves further than you. That's gone. And
I agree.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the point I'm making is Trump is not going to fix that. Trump is substituting that with cultural issues in that manner.
Now I guess J.D. Vance, who I think is a stroke of genius, is kind of as long as you don't look too much into the detail.
Well, that's
the he's in that space.
Exactly.
For people
on the surface. Okay,
we have failed again to solve America's problems this week, but we enjoy trying anyway. Before we finish up, Mick, your mother had a nice piece in the Examiner yesterday about Cork and hurling. She's a blow-in to Cork.
She's a blow-in. I handed over the column to her yesterday, Brendan. She's from...
Does your mother always say when she reads one of your pieces, sure, I could have written that.
She does, and she did. She's from serious hurling country in East Galway. She's a blow-in to Cork, and she's just writing about how famous Cork hurlers have always haunted her since she was very young, because Galway were always trashed by Cork. And you would appreciate this, she said, and they were beaten by everyone, but Cork, they were always appeared more cocky and confident than all the other counties that beat Galway at
the time.
Those
were the days, weren't they? we won't be cocky again. No, maybe. Yeah. Aisling, we've been ignoring what is, for many people, one of the huge stories growing over the last while and reaching a kind of a crescendo again this week, which is the scandal around Strictly Come Dancing.
I didn't know what you were coming out with there. Yes, Strictly Come Dancing. I mean, it's revelation after revelation. And I think
Give people the background, just in case the odd listener hasn't been following
There has been allegations against pro dancers on Strictly Come Dancing coming out in the papers in the last couple of weeks. One was Zara McDermott. She's an influencer online, let's say, and she was in on Strictly Come Dancing, and she alleged to have been kicked in one of her rehearsals with her pro dancer, who has now left the programme, an Italian guy. And
he's back working for €6 an hour as a labourer in Italy. Did you know that?
I didn't hear that. Everyone who was quoted, sources close to him, obviously saying that his career was ruined by these allegations and he'll never work in the UK again. And obviously being a pro dancer and Strictly Come Dancing is huge. I mean, they're nearly bigger celebrities than the celebrities that come on the programme. But hilariously, Anne Widdecombe was in the Mail today saying that, oh, you know, my mother, we lived through the Blitz, that these people shouldn't be so upset about. Now, that's kind of victim shaming as well, and these people are allowed to feel upset by what happened to them on Strictly. But at the same time, why was anyone taking a TV show of dancing that seriously, that they were, you know, committing certain abuses against their celebrity partners in order to win? So it's all a bit of a bit ridiculous, but it's going through the papers. I mean, there's an allegation after allegation.
It's convulsing the UK, actually.
Sorry?
It's convulsing the UK,
isn't
it? Yeah,
well, Strictly is
a huge institution there.
It's so loved in the UK. I mean, look, Dancing with the Stars is loved here as well. But I don't think Marty Morrissey will be coming out telling us that his pro partner was abusing him to get
good
the
God, woman, don't make any
no,
link there.
Well, I don't think anyone thinks that seriously.
We were doing so well, no. Yeah, okay.
I don't think the stakes are that high on Dancing with the Stars.
It goes back to that point that, like, all systems work to protect themselves, and there's constantly, where there's an imbalance of power, there, you know, that there's abuses are like,
yeah. What are we abusing?
Okay,
I'm
glad we
dancing?
Ended on an adult note there, Suzanne Rogers. Thank you very much. Okay, that's all we've time for today. Thanks so much to my very lively panel, Aisling Maloney of the Irish Daily Mail, Suzanne Rogers of Social Justice Ireland, Mick Clifford of the Irish Examiner, and David Quinn of the Sunday Independent. And we just take a quick break now.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Emailer says, thanks for pointing out that President Biden is frail rather than old, that many older people are extremely capable. Well, let me tell you, emailer, as somebody who's regularly left for dead watching Countdown with someone much older than Joe Biden, I know it well.